morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, December 5th, 2018. We start with the news section. Sight privilege. Do Durham parks and rec policies discriminate against the blind? Elvira Basnett was 15 years old when glaucoma closed in on her sight. She left her New York high school, where she was a freshman, to attend a school for the blind. But after a year spent learning how to get around and read Braille, she asked to go back to public school. I was being back in the mainstream, being back among people like myself, although I was just now blind, she said. I needed to be back out there in the world. 42 years later, Basnight is again asking for the opportunity to participate in the world as any sighted person would, this time from the City of Durham Parks and Recreation Department. In September, Basnight filed a formal complaint with U.S. Department of Justice against Park and Rec, saying, "Its mature adults program is discriminating by not providing a sighted guide for her or allowing her to bring her own guide without that person being charged a registration fee." In essence, she says, she's being double charged because of her visual impairment. The city has told her it would make an effort to waive fees for guides, but she argues that 28 years after the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the city should have written policy guaranteeing that consideration to anybody with an impairment. Basnight says in her 30 years in Durham, she has approached Parks and Rec off and on about including more activities for people with visual impairments. She's stepped up that advocacy in the past year as she nears retirement from a career at Duke ALS Clinic. The city's programs specifically for people with visual impairments, VIP programs as they're called, don't suit Basnight's appetite for exercise or adventure. "We don't need to sit down and play bingo and crochet," she said. So she looked to DPR's Mature Adults Program, which is for those 55 and up, and offers trip to attractions around the state. Basnight went on two such trips with the program, to the Black Mountain Chocolate Factory and a play in Sanford, holding on to the elbow of a Parks and Rec employee. But when she tried to sign up for a third excursion, she was told staffers could no longer guide her. Parks and Rec spokeswoman Cynthia Booth says the department's goal has always been to make DPR programs accessible to all participants, but it is unable to foresee the particular needs of each individual requiring a guide and doesn't have the staff to provide one. City Attorney Patrick Baker says having staffers, especially if they're not qualified, act as guides could pose a liability risk. Basnight said that she would prefer a guide be provided, whether that's a Parks and Rec employee or a volunteer. Participants in the Mature Adults Program have to register for trips in advance, and it's difficult to know who will be available to come along. Besides, Basnight says, she doesn't know a lot of people who are as active as she is. Registration for these trips is less than $100. For city residents, current offerings range from $6 to go to the Outlet Mall in Mebane to $75 for a buffet and a performance of Langston Hughes of Black Knight Nativity. Basnight says her complaint has less to do with cost than principle. How are we almost 30 years into the ADA and Durham is now just getting around to including us, she says. We want to educate the city of Durham. The American with Disabilities Act, which was prohibited discrimination against people with disabilities since 1990, requires public entities to make reasonable modifications so that programs and services are accessible. Basnight says she doesn't consider herself disabled, although her vision impairment qualifies her to file complaints under the ADA. The ADA is an important law because it doesn't just require everyone to be treated equally, says Jennifer Bills, who teaches disability law at UNC Chapel Hill. It does sometimes require public entities or employees to do something affirmative to even the playing field or even out access. In deciding if modifications are warranted, Bills explains, courts would look at an entity's resources and existing programming, then decide whether the modification is reasonable. The ADA doesn't require any changes that would result in a fundamental alteration in the nature of the service program or activity and undue financial or administrative burdens. Bill says she can't give a legal opinion on Base Knight's case, but given how low program costs are, it doesn't seem like an undue burden for the city to pay for a guide. They're not saying people with visual disabilities can't participate, Bill said. It is not facially overt, intentional discrimination, but it is having an impact that's disparate based on the person's disability. While Baker agrees that a $6 fee waiver here or there would seem to be a reasonable accommodation, he says it may not always be as simple as writing off the city's fee. For example, if a destination requires its own admission fee, his office has advised Parks and Rec to accommodate fee waiver requests from anyone with a disability. He also told Bass Knight the city would be providing her at a minimum all of the reasonable accommodations that would be required by the ADA, if not more. He's not sure, however, that a policy change is warranted. The ADA already requires the city to make accommodations, and as far as he knows, Bass Knight is the only person making this request. But Bass Knight says that's not enough. Instead, she said, Parks and Rec needs to change its policies and do more to reach people with visual impairments. I'm convinced there are a lot of blind people out there who were turned away and did not pursue it, she says. I didn't walk away. The next news article, The Hidden Epidemic. 2/3 of health outcomes stem from socioeconomic and environmental factors. Wake County sees that as an opportunity. In medical school, Raleigh internist Dr. Stuart Levine learned to examine patients as if they were in a vacuum, then use that information to assess a litany of symptoms, diagnose a problem, and prescribe a treatment. What he wasn't taught was how to address the underlying causes of poor health, which research increasingly shows is tied not only to behavior and access to quality health care, but also the socioeconomic circumstances and a person's physical environment. It makes me think outside of what I'm doing in the exam room, Levine said. It's not just a question of giving the patient the right medication or ordering a test. It's a much more. It's a community-based solution, and it's an attempt to start thinking about what health is. Health is not just health care. Levine co-chaired Wake County's Population Health Task Force, which sought to broaden the county's approach by infusing health outcomes into every stratum of government services, from law enforcement to land use planning. The Board of Commissioners unanimously approved the task force report on November 19th. County staffers are now developing strategies to implement the task force findings and will present them to commissioners in February. A core element of this effort is redefining the way the county thinks about health, not merely as a product of personal choices or DNA destiny, but as a symphony of social determinants. According to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's Healthy Communities Project, the biggest influence on people's health outcomes is their socioeconomic circumstance, including education, employment, income, and community support. This, along with environmental factors such as air and water quality, housing and transportation access, accounts for 50% of a person's health outcomes. An additional 30% is determined by behavior, diet, exercise, drug use, and sexual activity, while the remaining 20% stems from access to quality health care. What we now know is that your zip code is a bigger determinant on how long you are going to live than your DNA code, says Commissioner Sig Hutchinson, who also co-chaired the task force. One zip code difference can mean an 18-year difference in your life expectancy, as well as well-being within that life. The county sees this as a call to action. 70% of these factors are within its control. To improve the community's health, the county must first understand the role its services play and incorporate this understanding into training and policy. Every professional who works for Wake County not only has an impact on health and well-being of our citizens, but should be seen as a healthcare professional and should see their job from the perspective of how it impacts the health and well-being of our citizens. A major aspect of this effort begins with providing children with the skills and support they need to overcome adversity. An ongoing two-decade-long San Diego study on adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs, shows that childhood trauma has a substantial effect on a person's long-term health outcomes. The more childhood traumas, including neglect, sexual abuse, substance abuse, incarcerated relatives, divorce, and mental illness that a person is exposed to, the greater the risk of heart disease, cancer, stroke, depression, drug addiction, obesity, and diabetes, among other negative outcomes. The study showed that 64% of the population has at least one ACE, and more than 12% have four or more. The antidote to ACEs is a wide-ranging approach to public health focused on teaching county employees from all departments how to deal with trauma and build community resilience. This would entail everything from improved social services to crafting policies for land use, transportation, and economic development that prioritize public health. From a criminal justice standpoint, it means an emphasis not on holding people accountable, but also healing, says District Attorney Lauren Freeman. When we look at offenders who we deal with and prosecute that we know also have a history of similar types of abuse or addiction, trying to solve the root cause of their behavior is the best way to reduce recidivism going forward. Having endured some sort of trauma in childhood is fairly prevalent. County staffers may not realize that the work they are doing is interfacing with folks who may have experienced those sorts of things, and yet the data shows we all do. The task force recommends expanding the scope of the Community Health Needs Assessment, a component of the Affordable Care Act that requires tax-exempt hospitals to assess community health needs and gaps in care. The expansion would introduce social determinants as health factors that need to be assessed along with traditional metrics. It would also create an implementation plan based on the data from the CHNA. In addition, the task force wants to align ongoing public health initiatives with statewide efforts and create public-private partnerships with local businesses, philanthropic organizations, and government operations to coordinate and evaluate public health efforts. To spread awareness of ACEs and trauma-informed care, the local organization Advocates for Health and Action is screening the film Resilience, which reviews the findings of the San Diego ACE study and looks at ways to build community support systems through trauma-informed care. The next screening will take place at 8:30 a.m. on January 9th at Marble's Kitties Museum. And HEA will also be hosting a training session on December 10th at North Carolina State's McKinnon Center. It includes a free keynote address from Becky Haas, a trauma-informed administrator for Ballad Health, a healthcare provider servicing parts of Northwest North Carolina, Tennessee, Virginia, and Kentucky. Attendees can also attend a training session on trauma-informed practices from 10 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. for a $40 fee. And now this week's feature article, America the Broken. Wonder why everything in politics seems so foobar? Two UNC profs have an answer, and it's not reassuring. Although there are a number of qualities that people feel children should have, every person thinks that some are more important than others. I'm going to read you pairs of desirable qualities. You tell me which one you think is more important for a child to have. 1. Independence versus respect for elders. 2. Obedience versus self-reliance. 3. Curiosity versus good manners. 4. Being considerate versus being well-behaved. How you answer those four questions can predict a lot about you, whether you're more likely to live in the city or the suburbs, to watch the American Race or Mad Men, to eat at Red Lobster or Gursha, to name your daughter Catherine or Louise, to go to church on Sunday brunch, or to pursue higher education and not to drink a Michelob Ultra or a Trophy Cloud Surfer, to drive a GMC Yukon or a Toyota Prius. More important, how you answer says a lot about your politics. That's the thesis behind Prius or Pickup, how the answers to four simple questions explain America's great divide. The new book from University of North Carolina Chapel Hill political scientists Mark Hetherington and Jonathan Wheeler. Those who pick traits preferred centered on order, respect for elders, obedience, having good manners, being well behaved, have a fixed worldview, and are more likely to harbor racial prejudice and support politicians like Donald Trump. Those who go the other way are said to have fluid word views and are more likely to have supported Hillary Clinton. As we'll see, lots of caveats apply, and most people fall somewhere in the middle. Prius is something of a layperson's follow-up to Hetherington and Wyler's first joint publication, 2009's Authoritarianism and Polarization in American Politics, which showed that the Republican Party was unified less by small government principles than by authoritarian tendencies, a proclivity toward maintaining a social order that conservatives believe is under threat. Prius, which is mercifully lighter on statistics and ditches the pejorative-sounding authoritarian for the nicer fixed, expands on this concept for the Trump era. In the process, it offers a cogent and discomfitingly convincing argument for why everything in our political system seems irreparably shattered. Since the Civil Rights Movement, they write, our political system has become fundamentally polarized by these worldwide views. That, in turn, has led each side to distrust and even hate the other, to the point where we don't just consider our opponents wrong, but dangerous. On the right, this polarization congealed around Donald Trump, a politician who speaks to the authoritarian worldview better than any in the generation, and most dangerously, has led his partisans to shrug aside attacks on the free press, the rule of law, and other democratic norms. Politics, Hetherington and Weller argue, has become less about issues than our great reactions. As Hetherington puts it, we have what is not an ideological polarization per se, but rather what we call an effect of a feeling-based polarization. We believe anything about our political opponents. This is the perniciousness of this particular divide. I interviewed Hetherington and Wheeler at length last week in Chapel Hill. What follows is a condensed version of our conversation, edited for space and clarity. You can find the entire interview on our podcast, IndyCast, which you can download on Apple Podcasts or listen to at SoundCloud.com/IndyCast. The interview. The Indy Ask. Your first book came out in 2009, about the time the Tea Party emerged. It seemed prescient, because this was a group ostensibly organized around economic principles. But there was a cultural undertone to it. Why did you come to think that authoritarianism was such an organizing principle of conservatism? Hetherington answered, "One of the reasons I think people misunderstood the politics of this movement is that they were still thinking about ideology in the same way they did during the New Deal, that the Republicans are really the anti-government party and the Democrats are the pro-government party. That's not really the case anymore. What we noted was that this cascade of issues, from race to law and order to women's equality to sexual orientation, all of them were knitted together by one thing, and that is a concern about social change, not economic change, or anything along those lines. These groups, whether it was feminists or African Americans or any of these groups, they were all pressing the establishment hierarchy for new opportunities." The Indy goes on, "Prius argues that you can ask people four questions about child rearing, and based on their answers, you can predict a lot of information about them. Why are these questions so important?" The answer? It's off the wall, in a sense, that these things work the way that they do. But the questions are directed to people's understanding of what makes a good child. What makes a good child is a pretty fundamental thing to who we are as human beings, so that's probably a really important thing to start with. These are the questions that we ask to deduce the degree to which people are fixed in their worldview. They're more to traditional respect and obedience and good behavior. Or if their worldviews are more fluid, those would be people who favor independent children, who are curious. What we show throughout the book is that the answer to these questions predict very well people's opinions about gay rights, people's racial attitudes, people's opinions about immigration, people's opinion about gender roles, people's opinion about gun control, people's opinions about constitutional and biblical interpretation, people's opinion about basically everything that divides us deeply. It doesn't tell us anything about how big government ought to be, and that's what's important here. A different kind of ideology divides us about those things. But the things that we reasoned about in our guts, as opposed to in our minds, that's where these four items about parenting move the dial. The next question from the Indy. "My sense from your work is that fixed people tend to have a greater need for order, and they see greater value in maintaining and preserving the social order." The answer? The thing that really unifies everything in the level of threat and people perceive in the world, what we think this really turns on is the degree to which people view the world as a dangerous place. When Donald Trump was talking about Jamal Khashoggi's killing in the Saudi embassy in Turkey, what he started his statement with was, quote, "the world is a very dangerous place," end quote. He is appealing to this worldview, saying things are uncertain, and any deviation from what we're doing now, the traditional way of thinking about things, is potentially dangerous. If you think about it, in the social world, these traditions have tied us together, whether they're religious or whether they're about sexual orientation or women's role or racial hierarchy. Maybe they're not fair, but they've served us really well a really long time. And it could cast us in disorder and chaos if we change any of those things. People on the opposite side of the worldview divide. People who want independent kids, who are curious and outward-looking, they view it differently. If you want your kids out there being curious and independent, you must think of the world as a much, much safer place. Dr. Wheeler continued to answer, to the extent that they, the more fluid or liberal, see a threat in the world, it is precisely from those people who want to shut down that exploration and to prevent us from being more open to more diverse kind of society. There's a question on a 2016 political survey that basically asks people, which is closer to your understanding of reality? The world is a dangerous place, it's full of threat, we need to guard against it, or we live in a big, beautiful world that's safe to explore. And the responses are just as staggering. By 60 to 70 point margins, Donald Trump voters said that first view, the world is a dangerous place. And by the same inverse margin, Hillary Clinton voters said that closer to their view of reality was the sense that the world is a big, beautiful place, safe to explore. Heatherton went on, our world has always been about polarization. Why is politics so polarized if people actually don't care all that much on the issues? If people don't really care very much about politics, maybe they're not necessarily extreme on the issues. But here's the thing. What if you just completely understand the world differently from those on the other side of your guts? If you think the world is dangerous, and you see people on the other side thinking, oh, let's let refugees, immigrants into the country, that's dangerous. And those people aren't just people who disagree with those or other people who are dangerous to the country. But on the other side of that divide, those who are judging people without getting to know them because of the color of their skin or where they come from, those people aren't just disagreeable, they're dangerous, because their worldview is anathema to yours. So it's very hard for people on opposite sides of this particular divide to understand what the other side could possibly be thinking. The Indy asked, is authoritarianism and polarization, you wrote that election turn on people who fall in the middle, what you call mixed, not quite authoritarian, but not authoritarian. Heatherington answered, there are a couple of things about those who are in the middle of the worldview spectrum. The first thing is their opinions about the most divisive issues in American life, whether it's race or immigration or gender roles, and they tend to be closer to fixed than they are to fluid. And this gives people on the political right an advantage. When the fluid talk about things like structural racism, most people don't get that. And this is important for liberals to realize, actually. We tend to be in our own cocoons, our own bubbles. And as a result, we tend to think everybody sees the world the way we do. The second thing that I would say is, in the context of the present moment in politics, it doesn't matter so much how fixed or fluid people are. Almost everybody has put on a blue uniform or a red uniform. And so, as such, with partisanship so strong, the mix act like those who are at the extremes. Wheeler said, I do want to add one thing, though, to complicate this picture a little bit. While most people are being compelled to take sides, some people do sway, right? We just had a very different electoral outcome than we did in 2016. There are all sorts of reasons for that, but I think one thing that is true, speaking from a partisan perspective, we're lucky that Trump is as extreme and bad as he is, because he's turning off quite a number of people in the middle. If there was anybody with similar instincts about immigration who wasn't such a jerk about it, that would be a much more palatable way of packaging that worldview to people who would be inclined to agree, but whom Trump is just turning off. That obviously has implications for our politics now and in 2020. The Indy then asks, you note that American minorities tend to be more fixed in their worldview and yet vote like fluid people. Why is that? Wheeler answered, African Americans are the most extreme example in both directions. They answer the parenting questions in the most fixed way of any measurable group that we have, and they are by far the most reliably Democratic voters. In their case, I think we feel like the answer is pretty straightforward, which is that the Republican Party has proven itself so obviously hostile to them over a long period of time that they don't really have a choice. It's worth noting that these parenting questions that we're describing only really explain how white people think. But people of color are, of course, an incredibly important part of the history. And the reason is that their self-interest makes so clear that whatever ambivalence they have about the Democratic Party, they know where they stand with the Republican Party. This is a key part of the historical story. We talk a lot about working-class whites these days. If you go back to the Nixon years and the LBJ years in the 60s, working-class whites, whether they were in the South or whether they were in the northern cities, they were Democrats. And what Republicans realized was, we can peel some of those working-class white Democrats off by making appeals to race, by saying African-Americans are getting more than they deserve, and taking things away from you all. So the beginning of this worldwide divide is exactly this issue. It's Republicans trying to peel away old-time Democratic constituencies by making negative appeals to race. Then he says, Priya suggests that worldwide correlates with all sorts of personality traits and life decisions, down to how many kids you have and what you name them. What are these little quirks that you found that really surprised you about them? Hetherington answered, there are a couple of things that are really important to keep in mind. These correlations all exist. Democrats go to Starbucks. Republicans go to Dunkin' Donuts. Republicans drink light beer. Democrats are more inclined to drink IPAs. But we may have all these different personal experiences that cause us to be a little different. We're not necessarily saying that all liberals have these tastes for IPAs and fancy coffee and certain types of cars. There are plenty of liberals who drive pickups, and not very many conservatives who drive Priuses, but there are surely a few. But the key thing here isn't necessarily the behavior that people actually engage in. It's the caricature that develops about the other side of the choices that they make. One of the shows that the conservatives really love is Duck Dynasty. Duck Dynasty, of course, is a show about rural life in the South. Lots of guns, hunting, and so forth. All of those things are conservative identity things. One of my graduate students has shown that people identify that show more with Republicans than they do being pro-life on abortion. I mean, that's really remarkable. On the other side of it are yoga and foreign films. Those are things that liberals do, and people make that connection to the Democratic Party more clearly than they do being pro-choice on abortion. So the question is, if you're a Republican who encounters somebody with a yoga mat walking to a foreign film studio theater, do you want to talk to that person? Do you want to have anything to do with that person? Or have you made a judgment about that person even before anybody's uttered a word? Of course, the answer is the latter. And this is the thing that's so pernicious about the worldwide view. Because we have these markers of who we are, and they cross into the cultural sphere, it's making it much more challenging for people across the political divide to get to know each other and to realize that we're actually not that different. Maybe we are different, but we're not that different. Wheeler added, I grew up in Manhattan, the epicenter of godless liberalism, and I'm Jewish in the 1960s and 70s. Our food options? Where did we go out to eat when I was a kid? We went to Howard Johnson's. There was no Thai food. Americans did not have the same choices back then. Likewise, more people, or less people, had the same attitudes about disciplining children. There was no debate about gay rights before the 70s. I think this is important to understand, too. It's the proliferation of choice that makes possible the kind of divide we're talking about. One that both suffuses our political choices and our non-political choices, because we can now differentiate ourselves from other people in ways we have never would have seen 50 years ago. There's a physiological aspect to this, for instance. You say thick people tend to the stronger gag reflexes. Does that indicate the worldviews are baked into DNA? That was the next Indy question. Hetherington answered, it's probably the most controversial element in the book. What we mostly are trying to do there is to paint a picture of what the worldview divide is mostly about. A, it's about wariness, and B, it's automatic. In other words, people don't deliberate about the reactions to certain things. It's automatic. It's before conscious thoughts begin. This is a key to our understanding of polarization. We are acting automatically as opposed to. There is no way we're going to be able to see across the divide. Is this baked into us? I mean, do people come out of the womb hardwired to be conservative or liberal? We don't want to go that far. Even the people who do that biopolitics and genetics-based research would say that way of thinking is really a characterization of their research. These reflexes that we develop have something, probably, to do with our wiring, but they also interact with the early life experiences that we have. I want to add one thing here, Wheeler said, which is that wariness is not political destiny. It's wariness, in this way, very particular historical and political context that's being reinforced by the way the parties are divided, the issues that are being emphasized. The rhetoric of political leaders to make these instincts as political relevant as they are. I mention this in part to say that the role of leaders, of political elites, I don't think can be overstated. We're not making a biology is destiny argument. We're using that as a foundation to explain these different instincts and how, under the right circumstances, they can be exploited in the ways they are for political gain. The Indy then goes on, in 2016, what drew fixed people to Donald Trump as opposed to Ted Cruz or Jeb Bush, people who had conservative records? Wheeler answered, I would say that Trump was the dream candidate for the fixed worldview. The entire Republican Party had become an anti-immigration party over the previous several years. There was always been that rhetoric, but Trump owned and sold it in a way that we have not seen. I think it was even the language and rhetoric that he used. There were all kinds of studies during the campaign looking at the grade level of the candidate's language. Trump was like at fourth grade level. That doesn't mean that everybody who supported him has a fourth grade level education or understanding of the world. What's important is how clear and simple and black and white Trump was in communicating what he did. I think that was just an especially good fit for fixed world folks who wanted clarity. The Indian asked, what about the erosion of democratic norms under Trump? Is that what concerns you most about his presidency? Hetherington answered, this is really a remarkable moment. We have a president who refuses to sit for questioning from Robert Mueller, the special counsel, and nobody raises a fuss about it. Imagine if any other political leader took that stance. What concerns me most is how low the bar has become for him and his comportment as it relates to democratic norms. There's very little concern about these types of things from Republicans in Congress. They're not doing to stand up and say anything negative about Trump because his supporters are their supporters. If they alienate Trump, they alienate the base, and they may face a primary challenge in the next election. And then you think about the people in the electorate. Think about why these questions about child-rearing work. Do people want respectful children who are obedient and well-behaved? They want a tidy, not disagreeing household. What do these democratic principles like free speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, protecting minority rights? Wheeler went on, accountability for people who have authority. Hetherington, these people say all of these things are democratic principles, and they create untidiness. They create disagreement and discourse. We hate that. So if everybody would just listen to Trump, then everything would be okay. Democracy is institutionalized messiness. Where do we go from here? I mentioned earlier the potential for the Mueller report. My sense is it's not going to be positive. I think it's going to be devastating. And I'm so worried about what this means for the future. Will there be accountability? Or do people just rationalize it away because they don't want to believe it? This is both something that troubles me, but also encourages me in terms of what they've seen over the last year and a half. Every time Trump breached a norm, especially during the campaign, people responded, oh, that's disqualifying. And it drove me crazy because the whole notion is just based on this false premise that anything is disqualifying other than people voting against you. It turns out that these vaunted norms that we love to talk about are not nearly as solid or protective as we've always wanted to believe that they are. On the other hand, what I'm so heartened by, honestly, has been the incredible response in the last 20 months to what we've seen. The turnout in these midterm elections was staggering by American standards, our highest turnout since 1914. I'm encouraged on that ground. I feel like people are actually internalizing that notion that norms aren't going to save us. Only we are going to protect and save our democracy. The Indy asked, in 2004, the political scientist Morris Farina co-wrote a book called Culture War, The Myth of a Polarized America. It suggests that Americans are closely divided, not deeply divided. Your book, however, argues that the two camps are worlds apart. Are those two perspectives fundamentally incompatible? Hetherington said, I still teach that book. The reason I still teach it is because I actually think, in an odd way, it's still right. In some ways, it's a salvation. What Florina specifically suggests is that we're not polarized on the issues. In his view, our elites are what are polarized. And this is the idea that if we just sat down and talked to each other, we'd actually come to realize that. But what we would suggest is that it hardly matters that we're not so polarized on the issues. What's actually more consequential is how we're polarized. And that is, we're polarized in our feelings. So the nature of polarization is just different. I think Flory is still right as far as it goes. we're not miles apart necessarily on the pole, but we have got what we is not an ideological polarization per se, but rather we call an effect of a feeling-based polarization. And it might be even more important, because think about this. What we show in the book is we've come to hate the other side more than ever in the history of survey research. Weiler goes on, by the way, we don't like our side any more than we did 40 years ago. The only thing that's changed is how much we hate the other side. Hetherington added, exactly. And it's because they are characterized by this other world view that seems dangerous and that we just can't really understand. But here's the thing that's so important about that. You're probably a better person than I am, but I hate somebody. And I know that it affects every single thing that comes about our person. So if I hear a rumor about that person, am I willing to believe it? Hell yeah! Let's play this out with Donald Trump. Would you believe that Donald Trump refused to hug a child in the White House who has special needs? Yeah, you'd believe it. But it's not true. We'd believe anything about our political opponents. That is the perniciousness of this particular divide. The Indian went on, the worldview dynamic that you describe makes for a fairly depressing political outlook. To put it simply, are we screwed? Hetherington answered, I think this might be the natural way that Americans and all people are usually divided. Have we been divided like this before? If you look at the Electoral College map from 1896, it's almost exactly the same as the one now. It just flips by party. We've been there before, and we got out of it. But it's because the political elites decided that it was more advantageous to divvy up the county in different ways. And we also had a Great Depression, which caused the parties to stake out different ground. You ended up with a weird system where segregation South whites were in the same party as African Americans. So how do we get out of it? It's going to be political leaders to decide that this approach to things is no longer winning elections. Wheeler added, our optimistic scenario at the end of the book is that if there is some climate catastrophe or significant enough proportions, it might alter our sense of urgency about how we need to look to work together to solve problems. But of course, we don't really want to root for a climate catastrophe in order to bring about more political unity. I want to add one more optimistic note, which is that, especially from the perspective of what we all worried about in January of 2017, it's been an unnerving time in some ways. In other ways, our institutions have held pretty well. I mean, the Trump administration has been dealt one legal setback after another. They keep trying to find other ways to be horrible to people. But our courts are, maybe not just as much as we would like, delivering them very significant defeats. So I'm personally more optimistic than I was 20 months ago about our capacity to withstand somebody like Trump. And Hetherington finished, voters came through too in 2018. Institutions are holding up. They haven't been as tested as they might be, though, in the next couple of months. I was talking to my students the other day about the scenario that I mentioned about the Mueller report. What the students came back was, if people can't be convinced that collusion was determinative of the election outcome, people will ignore it. The motivation, if you're a Republican, is to ignore it. And I was thinking to myself, wow, I bet you that's right. I mean, we're talking about colluding with the country's most serious adversary to win a presidential election. And people are like, oh, that's disturbing. Now from the Indy page, Slippery Hope. Women have toppled the patriarchy, but at what cost? in Robin Kirk's cautionary tale of genocide. After publishing 3 nonfiction books on such subjects as guerrilla wars in Peru and the drug war in Colombia, not to mention her 3 decades' worth of human rights work in journalism South and Central America, Duke Human Rights Center co-chair Robin Kirk sets herself quite the challenge when writing her first novel. I wanted to write a book for young adults about genocide, about how easy it would be to fall into it, Kirk says over coffee at the 9th Street Bakery. The result is The Bond, the first installment of a planned trilogy published this month by Chapel Hill's Blue Crow Publishing under its nascent Golden Jay Books imprint for young adults. Todd is a striking voice of Denitra 584-K-A, known to her friends as Dini. The novel is set centuries into a dystopian future after a war between women and men all but wiped out, the latter. Now women are sown into life stations throughout genetic planning, while the remaining men are kept in containment to be used only for their genetic material until scientifically advanced can ensure that their terrible violence would be eliminated forever. We meet Dini in the morning of graduation day at the Collegium, where she and her classmates have been educated since they were 6 years old. Now they're awaiting their first 3-year job assignments, which could range from chef to navigator to sanitation worker, unless they preempt such duties by volunteering for the military and boarding one of the shining legion ships for parts unknown. If this first-person narration is a regimented world makes this sound like a cynical paint-by-numbers approach to young adult literature, allow me to disabuse you of that notation. In addition to her nonfiction, Kirk is a poet with an MFA in creative writing from the Vermont College of Fine Arts, and she did not set out to write a formula. I actually started writing the book in third person, she says. Laughing, she confronts the stereotype head-on with an impromptu affected outburst, another YA first novel, right? Yeah. I was having trouble finding the right voice, and so, as an experiment, I tried writing in the first person and felt an immediate connection. Told in 31 chapters of about 9 pages each, the novel is a crackling, interject piece. It also features an essential ingredient that Kirk knew she had to include to make the book work for the younger audiences that set out to reach, and that was hope. I was in Cambodia visiting the Memorial Museum to the genocide, and they were kids, 8 or 9 years old, and I just had a visceral reaction to that, she said, explaining that she waited until her own children were older before taking them to similar memorials. This story is a little less direct. There's a hopeful side that real life doesn't often have. Citing Philip Pullman, she continues, some subjects are too large for adult literature, but children are able to grasp these things. Early in the conversation, Kirk had mentioned an all-too-common Spanish phrase she learned in the course of the human rights work that translates to, there had to be a reason, uttered when a neighbor had been disappeared by a government or a cartel. It refers to what Kirk calls the underlying logic of genocide. It's the logic of Rwanda, Yugoslavia, and Cambodia. It's people in the abstract that they can hate. In her book, Kirk worked to avoid such abstractions, even regarding those we would regard as being on the wrong side of history. I hope I've achieved a level of complexity of characters, not pure evil, not able to be completely written off, she said. Kirk says her students at Duke, where she is a lecturer in the Department of Cultural Anthropology, also influenced the novel. It's the way they feel at times, out of place, she explains. They've been groomed to be one thing, say, a successful Wall Street financial analyst, and they get there and discover that they really want something quite different. With this book, I want to tell them, you are perfect as you are. You have talents you think are deficits, but are actually your superpower. If the novel sounds like it's full of lectures and overwhelming dark themes, I can disabuse you of that notion as well. One of the absolute breakout stars of this novel is an enhanced hybrid battle dog named 12, and a chapter on Dini's failures as a student closes with a memorial quote, "I am a furry, carnivorous potato." Kirk's warning against the slippery slope to genocide is not just hope, but adventure and humor also. Now from the music section, Sitar Hero. North Carolina Reggae Revival carves a space for Indian classical music in the Triangle. For hundreds of centuries, reggae has formed the backbone of Indian classical music, offering a guideline for musicians to improvise when performed live. Reggae's, which roughly translates to coloring, are still played throughout India and were first popularized stateside by the sitar master Ravi Shankar in the 60s. 40 years later, reggae is still seeing a renewed interest right here in the Triangle. A loose collection known as North Carolina Reggae Revival has been congregating every month over the past 4 years to jam reggae style and share a mutual passion. I was just a few musicians in the beginning, and I was beginning playing almost every show, founder Visashita says. Now it's becoming so successful that I play maybe only once a year, now as a solo artist. Shitness is a trained sitar player who is eager to find a new outlet in the Triangle to showcase his lifelong love for Indian classical music. Having spent years splitting time between North Carolina and Northern New York City, he's been inspired to Brooklyn Rugga Massive, a similar group that holds weekday classic sessions in New York City. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder that this program will be available as a podcast following its immediate first broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.